This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right. So, you know, we have three speakers, and we're going to try not to just crush you with PowerPoint slides, because I think the best part of these evenings is our Q&A. So we're going to go through three talks. We're going to try to stick to an hour. And then the three of us will come up and field questions. So my name is Tom Nyland. I'm in the Department of Psychiatry, and I've been in the field of sleep research for over 20 years. And with me tonight is Dr. Shelley Zak, who's a sleep medicine specialist, and Dr. Eliseos Karagiorgiou, who is a behavior neurology fellow with expertise in sleep. And Shelley is going to lead us off and is going to give us sort of a primer of the basic wiring of sleep-wake states. Eliseos is going to talk a bit about aging and dementia, and then I'm going to talk about insomnia and sleeping pills. So why don't we get started? Shelley.
Thanks. Yikes. Okay. So when I thought about doing this talk, is this too loud? Okay, sounds pretty loud to me. I first thought about two very interesting anecdotes in sleep medicine that really outline how curiosity and creativity ended up leading to developments in sleep science. However, in order for you to understand them, unfortunately, you're going to have to learn a lot about the neurochemistry of sleep. It will be a bit dry, but I'm hoping that it will prove to be interesting, because by understanding the neurochemistry of sleep, you'll be able to understand the side effects of some common medications and understand why does Benadryl make you sleepy. This will also form the basis, actually, for Dr. Nyland's lecture, as he will be talking a bit about orexin hypocretin. In addition, I'm going to end up going through the components of sleep theories, which involve clearly the neurotransmitters, the circadian and homeostatic processes, which I'll explain, and we're going to enjoy the learning about the flip-flop switch, which actually is probably better thought of as a teeter-totter. Okay, prior to the early 20th century, it was believed that sleep occurred just because you closed your eyes. However, a very bright Viennese psychiatrist, Dr. Konstantin von Economo, who is shown here with his aviator goggles because he also was an avid flyer, was working in the psych ward in Vienna and around 1917. So what's he seeing? He's mostly seeing soldiers with head trauma, right? But what starts to happen is he's starting to see people who are incredibly sleepy. They cannot maintain alertness. They are awake for only 4 hours a day. But when they're awake, they're normal, but they cannot maintain alertness. Conversely, he's also seeing people who are unable to sleep. And in addition, these patients also, some of them had some Parkinsonian features. The book Awakenings by Oliver Sacks was his experience with people from this time period. So it's going on now. It's 1917. This is the time of the Spanish flu. The Spanish flu was an epidemic that went through Europe, the United States, other parts of the world, and was actually referred to as the Spanish flu because many of the countries that were affected were actually involved in World War I, and this flu was affecting the soldiers and killing them. And so the military censors were keeping it out of the press. Spain was not involved, and so it was coming out in the Spanish press, and hence the Spanish flu. It was an H1N1 flu, such as what hit in 2010, more recently. So von Economo called this encephalitis lethargica for obvious reasons. He felt that there was an inflammation in the brain and it was making people sleepy. Now, a number of these patients died, and so von Economo was able to do autopsies on them. And in the process, he delineated two parts of the brain that he was able to describe in terms of sleep. A sleep center and the idea for a wake center. Now, this is sort of a brain, this is the brainstem and thalamus. This is the cerebellum. You can think of the cerebellum as, let me back up. This is the brain cut this way, as if you took a chainsaw and went blah. So the cerebellum you can think of as controlling sort of, it coordinates motion, stability, essentially. The brain stem is a very phylogenetically old part of the brain, and so it has a lot of very, very basic functions, including respiration. In this case, you can see he outlined the oculomotor nerve, eye movements, and all sorts of other stuff. This is the thalamus, which is where sensory information comes from the outside. Up here, that's not pictured, but you're going to see it a little later, is the cerebral cortex. That's more what you think of when you think of brain. That's the part of you that's thinking, that's paying attention, that may be sleeping. Tracks go from the brain down, from things up, but then right in here, in this part of the brainstem leading to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is a very interesting part of the brain. It controls a lot of stuff. It controls sleep, which is what we're going to get into in gory detail. It controls temperature, feeding, growth hormone comes out of here. Cortisol is controlled in here. So the hypothalamus is a pretty important part of your brain. And so what he determined was that when he saw damage to this part of the section between the brainstem and the and heading up towards the hypothalamic area, these patients could not maintain alertness. And so he posited that there were arousal systems going from here heading upwards that were being blocked. Similarly, the patients who could not sleep, the severe insomniacs, had a lesion here. And this is where he thought that the center for cells that controlled sleep were. And actually, this arrow is pointing to where he felt probably narcolepsy, which they were also seeing, might have been controlled. This is a prettier picture. Now, just a couple things. I just want you to understand that when you see this line here, okay, it's not going through there. It's coming all the way up and in, okay? This shows you the neurotransmitters that are involved in wakefulness. And I'm going to go through them in a little more detail in a second. So you can imagine that if you put a lesion right there, that all the processes coming here are going to be blocked. They're not going to be able to get up here. Now, if we look at these as all these congregations of wake-promoting nerves, this is the VLPO. It's our friend for sleep, the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus. Don't worry about the name, but the idea is that this nucleus produces chemicals that I'm going to go into, GABA and GALNIN, that inhibit the wake-promoting cells. So you can imagine that, again, if you put a lesion here, you're going to prevent the inhibition coming from the wake-promoting cells. Now, let's just take a moment and look at what the chemicals actually are. So the wake-promoting neurotransmitters include histamine, acetylcholine, norepinephrine, noradrenaline. It's an adrenaline-type medication. Histamine's coming from here. Norepi's coming from here. Acetylcholine's coming from here and in here. Serotonin here and also probably some down here. Dopamine, my absolutely favorite chemical. And orexin, which we're going to talk about, which is right around there. So knowing these chemicals, that these promote alertness, that explains why antihistamines, that's why they make you sleepy, okay? They oppose histamine, at least the ones that cross through the blood-brain barrier, the more recent antihistamines not doing so. Anticholinergics, it's a classic side effect of medications, probably more classically seen with older antidepressants. You do see it with some of the newer ones, but less frequently. Anti-dopaminergic meds. When would you take an anti-dopaminergic med? Well, some of the anti-nausea meds, and more prominently probably the antipsychotics, some of the more recent ones like Seroquel, even sometimes used for sleep, and then the anti-orexins, which is what Dr. Nyland's going to be speaking about. Now, in order to understand where the neurochemistry that controls sleep, you need to understand a little bit about sleep. I don't expect you to be able to read sleep studies after this. I just want you to get a visual picture of what's going on. So this is the EEG tracing when you're awake with your eyes open. This is awake with your eyes closed. This is the EEG tracing when we see someone in drowsy, what we would call N1 or very light sleep. This is N2 or light sleep. This is N3 deep sleep. And this is REM, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But ignoring REM, look at these patterns. You can see that as you go deeper and deeper into sleep, the brainwaves get slower and bigger. Now, depth of sleep is defined by how hard is it for me to wake you up? How loud a bell do I have to ring? How much do I have to pinch you? And so as you're getting deeper, what's really happening is that the brain is sort of getting deafferented. Basically, the thalamus, where all these sensory stimuli are going, is starting to have some of its more inhibitory neurons. The neurons that suppress firing are starting to get engaged to prevent the brain from getting the sensations. Now, if you look at REM, REM is really an interesting stage of sleep. If you look at this EEG, what's it look like? It looks much more like the EEG of wakefulness. Some aspects of it look like the EEG of light sleep. And in fact, REM sleep is at a depth more akin to light sleep than actually deep sleep. A lot of people think REM is deeper. It's not actually deeper. It's just different. REM sleep is also interesting, and we're going to go over it. I'm going to be talking about this a little later. In that, in REM sleep, you're effectively paralyzed. Now, clearly, you're not totally paralyzed, or we wouldn't have rapid eye movements, right? Also, your diaphragm, the bottom part of the lungs, is moving, or you wouldn't breathe. And finally, there's a middle ear muscle that moves for a reason that I have no idea. But in any case, REM sleep is characterized by brain waves that look closer to wakefulness, but muscle that is effectively paralyzed, with a few exceptions. And in fact, in REM sleep, we see that the brain is equally active as it is in wake sleep. Now, knowing that, if you look here, this is a hypnogram. This is actually, hypnograms are great. This is a timeline. This is midnight, 7 in the morning. So we're looking at stages of sleep through the night, and I think you'll see other examples of this later in the evening. Wake is always at the top, and as we go lower, we get deeper and deeper. This is older nomenclature, S1 and S2. They're now N1, N2, and 3 and 4 combined. So anytime you see a line here, the person is awake. This is very light, drowsy, essentially, light sleep. And then this stuff is deep sleep here. And then REM sleep, which is on the bottom because it just looks good that way. It's not really any deeper. And what you can see is that you have cycles between non-REM, REM, non-REM, REM, non-REM, REM, going throughout the night at approximately 90 to 120 minute intervals. And the REM periods actually get bigger and the deep sleep gets less. Now, I put that in so that you'll start to understand that not only, I'm not even really going to talk about this, but I sort of put this in for thoroughness sake, that the chemicals involved in REM are not only those that promote REM, which are essentially acetylcholine and glutamate, but there's this back and forth between REM going on and then REM being inhibited and going off, and then REM going on and going off. And what's going on back and so this is, you have your REM on cells and your REM off cells. And REM on is acetylcholine and glutamate, and REM off is norepinephrine and serotonin. Now, these names should sound a little bit familiar, because acetylcholine, norepinephrine, serotonin, these are all chemicals of wakefulness. During this, so acetylcholine actually fires a lot when you're awake, and then it goes down during non-REM sleep, and then it goes back up during REM sleep. While these fire most during wake, and then they damp down. So looking at this, what's working for the REM, so what's happening in non-REM is that you have firing of right this part of the brain, giving GABA and GALAnin. These are inhibitory chemicals. And then when you enter REM, you have the REM on cells firing the acetylcholine and glutamate, and then they'll be followed by the REM off cells, the norepinephrine and serotonin. Now, GABA. GABA is a great chemical. It is a great receptor. Probably the one you're most familiar with, alcohol. Where does alcohol work? It works on GABA receptors. GABA is sedate. Clearly, GABA helps you sleep. So GABA is sedating. Up until recently, most of the sleeping pills, the sedative hypnotics, worked through GABA. Anti-anxiety medications, not all, but many, work through GABA. And another favorite is progesterone. Wonder why pregnant women are so happy and relaxed? GABA. And then the REM is the norepi, and the REM is acetylcholine glutamate, and then inhibited by norepi and serotonin. Okay, we actually are going to get to a cute story. Sorry about all of the science, but it is the science of sleep. So there are two theories of how we end up going from one system to the other. You'd think at this point it would be simplified. It would be in a single theory. It's always bothered me that there are two, but this is where we still in this day and age are. The first one, the circadian theory, process C. The circadian theory talks about the biological clock. You've probably all heard about it. When it comes to sleep, we like to think of it as a gate. The gate opens when it's easy to fall asleep, closes, making it hard to fall asleep. And so you can think of it as promoting wakefulness. This is the morning and early afternoon, and then the gate opens and you get drowsy. This is the siesta time. And then it's harder to fall asleep in the early evening, and then as you get into the nighttime, it becomes easier to fall asleep. Now, this also explains why if you pull an all-nighter, you get sleepier, sleepier, sleepier. So 5 in the morning, you could just collapse. But come 8 or 9, you feel worse. You feel more tired, but you try to lie down and you can't sleep. That's this process. The gate is closed. Now, in addition to that, we talk about process S for sleep. Sleep specialists are just not that creative. And that refers to the homeostatic drive for sleep. And that that's been around for a really long time. I can't remember when, but long time ago, that if you took the spinal fluid from sleepy dogs and you inject it into awake dogs, guess what they would do? They'd go to sleep. So that led to the belief in somnogens, that there are these chemicals floating around that produce sleep. We now have them a bit more defined: adenosine, prostaglandin D2, tumor necrosis factor alpha, and interleukin 1, as well as nitrous oxide. So you can see process S is the homeostatic drive for sleep. The longer you're awake, the more of these you make, and it's pushing you towards sleep. And it's where these two processes are balanced that determines whether you're awake or asleep. And so we as sleep specialists, when people come in and they're having trouble sleeping at night, one of the first things we ask is, are you taking naps? Because as you enter sleep, your somnogens fall down. And so by taking a nap, you will get rid of some of these and thus not have a high enough drive towards sleep when the gate is open. So all of this is sort of some background to understand narcolepsy and what was a really fortuitous and clever, clever discovery, which are the sleepy mice that defined one of the latest theories in not only sleep regulation but also narcolepsy, orexin. So narcoleptics, you probably have seen in discussions of it, but basically narcoleptics are sleepy. They fall asleep while talking, they fall asleep while eating, driving, which is what scares us. But the main thing is, forgetting they're sleepy, the main aspect is they cannot maintain wakefulness. Conversely, during the night, they cannot maintain sleep. There's sort of this disconnect. They're going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. The balance is off. One of the interesting other aspects of narcolepsy is that probably the main one of it, you have cataplexy. Cataplexy is the sudden loss of muscle tone provoked by a strong emotion. It can be anger. It can be laughter. In fact, neurologists used to have joke books so that they could try to induce a cataplectic attack in the office before we had better studies for this. Consciousness is maintained. It's a loss of motor tone. I described for you how in REM sleep you lose your motor tone. It's kind of akin to that, and it can be manifest by a head drop, total collapse of the body. Stanford is famous, and we'll get into that in more detail. These are the narcoleptic dogs. I don't know how to import a video, but you can go on YouTube and you can watch the dogs, and they're running around, and then whoops, they collapse because they got very excited. They'll be back up very soon. It's very brief. Now, the story behind narcolepsy began with the search for obesity. In 1998, two papers were published within a month of each other. Delici and Kildoff were looking at proteins in the hypothalamus and trying to purify them and figure out what they do. So they knew they were working with the hypothalamus, so they called their proteins hypocretins. They actually described pro-hypocretin and then its two byproducts because it was from the hypothalamus and it looked like a gut hormone called secretin. The same time, Sakurai and Yanigasawa were looking at what they called orphan receptors that they didn't know what actually complex to them. So they found a chemical and they injected it into rat brains and they started to eat. So they called it orexin for appetite. Okay, so the next thing you do is you make an animal model. So they made a mouse that didn't have any orexin and they videotaped these mice. And somebody very cleverly was watching them and noticed that the mice kept collapsing during their active period, which is nighttime. And then they started to study them, and they saw these mice that were sleeping more during their active period than they should be. And somebody went and just said, "You've got narcoleptic mice." So this became a second animal model for narcolepsy. This was the discovery of orexin/hypocretin and its role in the fact that its absence will create narcolepsy. At the same time, Mignot's lab at Stanford, they have their Dobermans, and they saw in the Dobermans, not in people, but in their animals, that it's a problem with the receptor. So in people, they've shown that there's a 90% reduction in orexin-producing neurons, as well as little to no orexin being produced in the spinal fluid. This gets us very close to the end. So now we realize that from looking for a model of obesity, they found a model for narcolepsy. And this ends up going to the flip-flop switch theory. So the flip-flop switch is apparently a theory in engineering that it's either one state or it's another. You're not both. You're going back and forth. So they always talk about the flip-flop switch, and they always show a seesaw. But be that as it may, that's the lingo. And so the question was, we have these parts of the brain that I sort of glossed over earlier that are making TMN's got to be histamine. I can't read it. Histamine, serotonin, norepi. And then we have the other part of the brain that induces sleep, that's producing a lot of GABA. And so one's more active, the other's more active. What is actually controlling this seesaw? And the thought is that it may be orexin coming out of the lateral hypothalamus, that during the day what is allowing you to maintain this wake state and not be dropping off every couple hours during the day is the continuous production of orexin during the day that actually then gets damped down at night, and that it is allowing you to maintain the wakefulness state. So basically, because of a very smart psychiatrist, we were able to figure out that the control for sleep involves the brainstem and the hypothalamus in different places and in different loci. This allowed the development of sleep-wake networks running up and down the brainstem into the cortex, the more thinking part of the brain, that there are a lot of neurotransmitters involved that will explain some of the common side effects of common medications, and that the biological clock along with the development of these sleep-promoting factors, the rise of these somnogens, actually help modulate which way these systems are going, and that you really think of it as sort of a flip-flop switch that's under the control not just of the biological clock and the homeostatic factors, but that you have hypocretin orexin actually controlling it, and that this discovery turned out at the same time, sort of like the calculus, and that it was actually occurred because they were looking for obesity. So I thank you very much, and now I think, Dr. Caraggio is up.
So I'm a behavioral neurologist. I have an interest in sleep and dementia. And what I'll try to do, what I'll outline, first of all, I'd have no conflicts of interest. And what I will try to do an outline is very briefly go over why we sleep and how we sleep, and then focus over what changes happen in sleep over aging, and then what changes we see in dementia patients as far as sleep is concerned. And also we'll build on a new new findings over the last few years where actually sleep changes can increase the risk of developing a degenerative disorder or degenerative findings in the brain. And then the more important part, what can we do as individuals, and also what can our physicians do to help us? So very briefly, do we really need to sleep? Is there any practical purpose for anybody sleeping? And there's two main concepts as far as a neurologist is concerned. On one hand, you allow a restoration. Your tissues through sleep get restored. But also there's a very strong reorganization that happens during sleep. You get your synapses that reflect memory consolidation practically remodeled throughout the sleep cycle. And there's also some ecological benefits potentially. And we already talked about both the circadian rhythm, the C process, and also the sleep process, the homeostatic process. Practically, you have these two states in the brain, while you're awake and when you're asleep. And early on, as you are awake, you start building different neurotransmitters, adenosine being a prominent one. And it eventually tells your brain, all right, you're very, very tired. It's time that you fell asleep. But as Dr. Zach said, well, if you pull an all-nighter in the early morning, you can't really fall asleep. Again, because it's not just enough. My cousin, when we were 5 or 6 years old, I told him, hey, it's 10 o'clock at night. We've been up all day. We're so tired. Why can't we sleep? And he says, hey, it's not enough to just be tired. You need to be sleepy. And he was 6 and 7. So if you understand it at that age, you probably figure it out now. And that's the second part. How do you enter? How does your brain get into that circadian regulation, that internal clock? And that is mostly controlled through our internal clock of the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which gets information from light exposure. That's why we tell our patients, hey, go out in the sun in the morning, get that consolidated, and that will eventually block initially melatonin production. But when night comes, you see that melatonin starts to increase, and that starts to give your body the sense, okay, it's now you're sleepy. What's also interesting is that same nucleus indirectly also controls your body temperature, and they're anti-correlated, these two. So when your body temperature starts to decrease is when you start becoming sleepy, okay? And practically you have this variation throughout the day where as your body temperature increases, you're fully awake, and then as it starts to decrease, you start becoming sleepy and so forth. Okay. And each, we talked about the sleep architecture, that during your sleep you have cycles. Through these cycles you go through deep sleep, deeper, 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 and then you get a REM episode, a REM period, and then you have another cycle. So each one of these is one of these cycles. And we talked that each one is defined by the brain waves from the EEG. What's important is that each one, from a memory perspective, allows you to encode, to consolidate memories better. But specific types of memories. So if you're in one of these deep cycles, the slow wave sleep, as we say, you encode episodic memories, things that happen to you and you remember the next day and you say, oh yeah, I remember that. But then when it has to do with procedural memories or emotional memories, and that has to do, for example, how well somebody can shoot a basketball into the hoop, that's not something that you remember doing explicitly. It's a process that you learn through several procedures. And that's something important for REM sleep. And just breaking it down, same thing here. Just don't focus on everything. There's just a couple of things I want you to focus here. One is that during this period, which is the REM sleep, so in one cycle in the REM sleep, one important neurotransmitter that's increased is the same neurotransmitter that's increased during wakefulness. That's acetylcholine. And I highlight it because when we talk to our patients, when we treat our patients that have Alzheimer's disease, we give medications that increase the levels of acetylcholine. But that same neurotransmitter is low during other periods of the night, and it has to be low to allow other types of memory to occur. And actually, if you look at the brain, which parts are active during the different periods of the night or the cycle, the hippocampus, the area that has to be more active during memory encoding episodic memory, is during non-REM sleep, and vice versa. The cortex and the frontal lobes are more active during that REM sleep. Okay, so classical thinking says that, okay, if I have a problem in my brain, I will get some problem with my sleep. If a specific center that controls sleep is affected, I will have problems with sleep. And thinking a bit before the full-blown deficits happen, is there anything normal as far as aging and sleep? Is there something inherent to the aging process that, okay, it's expected that as you age, you will change some aspects of your sleep. Some things that are characteristic are, first of all, the melatonin secretion, which allows you to say which time of the night you will be more sleepy. If this is a young adult, and melatonin is secreted between whatever, in the middle of the night, let's say. If you're a teenager, this is a bit shifted. So it's not weird that your teenage kids or grandchildren are actually up later. They are partying too, but they're also having a melatonin secretion at later times. But then as you age, your melatonin starts to get secreted earlier. And it is still the same amount of melatonin. But when you also get into advanced dementia stages, the sleep patterns really break down, and also melatonin patterns start to break down. And other aspects that are different as we age is that as a baby, you sleep as a baby, like a baby. You go into that deep sleep, an airplane may be passing by, the baby won't wake up. But then as you're growing older and older and older, you don't get into these deep stages as much, and you stay in those more lighter stages. Your REM sleep is also smaller. So you end somewhere in between most of the night. And then there are some characteristic patterns that come up with aging and in populations that they were just observed, people that didn't have any cognitive problems, just observed for sleep patterns, and they found certain characteristic changes. So it's more likely that people nap during the daytime with aging, but this also has an association to risk for having any type of mortality, any type of risk of death being earlier by about 15 to 30%. But if you have gone through an all-nighter, napping the next day is a good thing because it allows your body to recuperate. Also, the breakdown that we talked before does become more evident as we age. And actually, this is one work over here by Christine Walsh, where you do have a faster cognitive decline if you end up having more breakdown of your sleep patterns, and also you are at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Something that's very interesting over the past few years is there's several studies, the biggest one by the WHO, on how long you sleep. So you have people saying, okay, I don't sleep long enough, I'm tired all the time. That makes sense on having poor cognitive function. That's what these inverse U curve shows, that if you don't sleep long enough, you don't perform as well on cognitive tests. But there's these people that come to clinic and they say, I sleep great. I sleep 10 hours every night. And when you hear that, you should go, damn, that's not good. And actually, that is even worse than sleeping less than 6 hours every night, comparatively. Having insomnia is a bit of a mixed bag. There are some features that could be good or non-concerning and some other features that could be concerning. But at this point, we don't have a definitive answer as far as dementia or aging, I should say, is concerned, and risk for down-the-line dementia is involved. A big part, and I'm sure you've heard of sleep apnea or sleep disorder breathing, is in aging is that, and also in dementia eventually. So there's these two big studies, and these were done by Christine Yaff here at UCSF, and there are big population studies, and they looked at women separately and men separately, but they really came up with the same result. So they took women and men that either had sleep apnea or they didn't have sleep apnea. What they found was that the ones that did have sleep apnea were more likely to develop dementia down the line, either mild cognitive impairment or full-blown dementia. It was more prominent in the men compared to the women, the risk of having a dementia down the line if there was a sleep disorder breathing. But both indicated that the mechanism was actually a hypoxia. As you are not breathing well, you don't get enough oxygen to your brain. And recently there was a pathological verification. So somebody cut down the brains of these people and found that there are microinfarcts in the brain. And it's important because we can treat that. Sleep disorder breathing is something treatable, whether you want a full mask or a nasal mask or other approaches if you have milder deficits, it is something treatable, so something to consider. And also our breathing as we enter this deeper, our brain perfusion, the ability to for the heart to send blood to the brain during this deep sleep is decreased. So you need to get more oxygen during that period of time. Otherwise, you'll have more hypoxia, more episodes. So now the question is, I've told you all these things that are risk factors for eventually developing dementia. Does it mean that if you see something, if somebody has a problem, they will develop a degenerative problem? So there was some very interesting, there are a few studies, but one nice example is this one, the Sleep in America survey. And what they did was they called people and they tried to identify what's the risk of having a sleep problem if you have another comorbidity, and it could be anything. And really what happened was that people that had a sleep problem or were more likely to have a sleep problem were more likely to have more comorbidities. So if you had more than one, so let's say hypertension and high cholesterol, you could have a sleep disorder by 40% chance you had a sleep disorder. Okay. And there were some other studies that also indicate that. So there is this evidence that really having sleep problems as you age is not something that should be expected. And Ancoli Israel, a prominent sleep and dementia researcher, says that just having sleep problems alone, just aging alone, doesn't mean that you'll have sleep problems. It's all the things that go with it. With the aging process that lead to the sleep problems. That can be illnesses, it can be medications that you take as you age, circadian rhythm disorders that you may have, or primary sleep problems directly relate to sleep. So for me, specifically as a behavioral neurologist, I'm interested, okay, so I see people that are aging or they have a dementia, and they say, I have a sleep problem. Should I be concerned? So there's... should they be concerned for having a degenerative process that's advancing? So there's this nice work by Rikos and Koppel, who works from the Netherlands, who works also here at UCSF with Gil Rabinovich. And what the interesting finding is that they took pictures of the brain with a PET scan, and they looked at how much amyloid people have in their brains. And they said, okay, if you have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, it is very likely that you have amyloid in the brain. And there are some other factors in that with aging, this probability is decreased. However, more importantly, more interesting to me is that as you age, even if you have no cognitive deficits, it's much more likely, and that's this black line, to have amyloid in the brain. And amyloid is related to Alzheimer's disease. So if you have a certain genetic factor, if you're so you hear APOE4, for example, and you're 75 years old, the chance of having amyloid in the brain is 50%. It's much less if you're negative. But this is important because if you are more likely to develop, to have amyloid pathology as you age, you start thinking, okay, what does that mean for the brain and what does it mean for sleep? So when people come to me and say, okay, I have these problems with my cognition, it could be memory, it could be behavior, it could be orientation, navigation, seeing, what I think is that, okay, depending on the pattern you give me, I'm thinking of a different dementia. It can be Alzheimer's, it can be Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia, it can be primary progressive supranuclear palsy. And I mentioned those three because those three, early on in their presentation, affect the brainstem. So we talked about all these nuclei that control sleep. So if early on, even before they hit the cortex, those abnormal proteins go and reach those central nuclei, you would expect to have sleep disorders in people without having any cognitive deficits. And practically, this is one interpretation of why, as we age, we see more frequent sleep disorders in people. So, putting it all together, sleep disorders in healthy agers partially predict future dementia, exactly because these centers are involved. And there are specific not all the dimensions will have that pattern, but the ones that do affect the brainstem early on, and that does include Alzheimer's disease, it does include Lewy body dementia, it does include progressive supranuclear palsy, are more likely to also be associated with sleep disorders early on. And they don't have to be extreme or out of proportion to what somebody would otherwise think for aging, but if you do more detailed evaluation, you may be able to pick them up. And some of them do have unique characteristics. So you come to me and you say, I'm really living the dream, doc. And every night my wife says that I'm throwing hoops or I'm beating somebody. And yesterday I even beat her and she was complaining. But it's really, you are going through REM sleep. You're having a dream, a very vivid dream. And because the centers that make you paralyzed don't work anymore, you end up acting it out. But that's a very unique case. Most of the disorders that we see that overlap, the sleep disorders that we see overlap in the dementias, have to do with the sleep patterns, the napping, the breakdown of the circadian rhythm, the sleep disorder breathing, things like that that we mentioned before. So practically now, putting this trajectory from brain pathology, brain degeneration to sleep disorders, you have these pathways where you have an increased alertness during sleep. So you don't get into that deep sleep. Your brain fires more. And then you also complain of insomnia. There's studies that show that even though we think somebody is sleeping, their EEG shows that it's very fast. It's as if it's a waking EEG. And we're not talking about, well, not fully waking, but more active. And it's not REM sleep. And these people complain of insomnia even though we think they're asleep. But what? And they are right. They are partially awake in their sleep. And that also they have lighter sleep, and also they break down their sleep because it's easier to wake up. It's also the separation between the alertness center, the wakefulness center, and the sleep center is not as complete. There starts to be an overlap between the two. So you end up having fragmentation entering in and out of sleep more. What's the result? You don't sleep well, you don't rest well, so you're sleepy during the day, and you have one sleep disorder. Also, if you end up affecting also the arousal centers and you don't send acetylcholine, as we said, and other neurotransmitters during the day, you end up being sleepy during the day. That's why when we say, okay, take this medication for Alzheimer's disease, we say take it during the day because it also stimulates you and perks you up. Also, the earlier, the shift that we talked about, that melatonin is secreted earlier as we age, yes, it causes an advanced sleep phase. What happens then? Then people say, okay, I'm sleepy, I may be tired, but I want to stay awake. I mean, it's only a quarter to eight, and I want to listen to that talk. I want to go eat afterwards. I want to spend time with my grandchildren. And then the melatonin effect passes, and then you're awake all night. Or you sleep for a bit, and then you're awake at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. So that's another problem. You have sleep maintenance insomnia. But also, in advanced dementia, you end up seeing more people having sundowning because you have this sleepiness, so you have these intrusions of sleep states, even though you're awake. And sundown is, I didn't explain it, is an effect where dementia patients behave erratically, if you want. They are confused, disoriented. They may see things at times or talk gibberish. And one of the explanations is that you have intrusions of this sleep state during the wakefulness because it shifted. Okay, but we talked about that there's recently a bidirectional relationship. And we know now, especially in animal studies, but some human studies, that if there are sleep disorders, if you force your lifestyle to screw up your sleep, you're more likely to develop a degenerative process later on. So as a background, there is evidence in mice that the more you stimulate the mice, either through tactile stimulation or you stimulate them chemically to have an active synaptic activity, the more amyloid deposition happens at the synapses. So there is this association where the neurons fire more and there's more amyloid deposition. That's what this graph shows, where the amount of amyloid increases with the amount of activity. In this case, it was represented through lactate. Now, That leads to the obvious question, okay, what if I modulate the sleep-wake cycle of mice or humans eventually, but can I verify that if mice sleep longer or if mice sleep less, that will translate to an effect to the amount of amyloid in their brain? And the answer is yes. So over at WashU, they took these mice that are more likely, they're genetically modified, more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease or Alzheimer's-like pathology in the brain. So they went through different manipulations. In one state, they said, okay, we'll increase their sleep. They did actually through orexin mechanisms. They increased that slow-wave sleep. And they found that from the situation where you would have a lot of amyloid, all these black dots and reveal amyloid, that amount was less comparatively when sleep was increased, that deep sleep. Vice versa, they took them and they said, okay, now you're awake. And again, through manipulations, they forced them to remain awake. And even though they did develop amyloid pathology in the normal state, if you want, in the sleep-deprived state, that amyloid deposition was more increased. Okay, so overall, that means that at least in mice, sleep is good for avoiding amyloid deposition. So coming to humans now. So across the bay, there's another campus called Berkeley, and the people over there are actually doing some really nice stuff, cool stuff. And they took normal people, and they said, okay, can we sort of see if sleep and amyloid deposition are related in normal people? Not in people that have Alzheimer's and they're advanced. People that whose cognitive function is great, or normal anyway. So they took 26 cognitively normal participants, and they had them do a task before they slept and a task the day after. They also had images of their brain, and that's this top part, of seeing how much amyloid each of these people had in their brain. Remember that curve that as you age, it's more likely to develop amyloid. So practically, these people belong to different parts of a specific age. So average age is 75, and some of them have more and some have less amyloid. Then they also looked at how much deep sleep do these people achieve and how is that translated. And what it showed was that the ones that had less deep sleep and those brain waves in that medial frontal area that we talked before in REM sleep, that area over here that is more active during REM and less active during slow-wave sleep, that showed very consistently that they were more likely to have increased amyloid pathology in that area also. So there is this relationship, even in humans, that getting into a slow-wave sleep, getting into that deep sleep, is at least associated. We can't definitely say there's a causal effect yet, but it is at least associated with less amyloid pathology. And also the cognitive test that they performed did show that these people also performed better. The ones that were able to go into deep sleep also performed better the next day. So what happens during the sleep process, during sleep on amyloid? So there's a few things that happen. One thing is that you during that deep sleep, you can pick up more amyloid leaving the brain from your CSF, your cerebrospinal fluid, the fluid that comes from the brain. But also part of it leaves through your blood. 60% leaves through your blood. The other 40% leaves through other mechanisms, including the CSF. Now, as you don't have amyloid pathology in the brain, that fluctuation where while you're awake, you have less amyloid getting thrown out, and during sleep, you have more amyloid, you get rid of more amyloid, that fluctuation, that sinusoidal wave, becomes less as you start developing amyloid plaques. This is mouse studies, I should clarify that. So that ability to clear the amyloid from your brain becomes less prominent as you start developing amyloid plaques in the brain. That's important because it also tells us that if we want to get rid of amyloid in the brain, we have to hit the disease early, because later on in the process, we won't be able to clear the amyloid through these traditional mechanisms as easily. Okay, and practically this brings us now to the full circle of how sleep disorders can add can lead to brain degeneration. And the patterns we discussed was increased neuronal activity during your sleep leads to more amyloid deposition, which is related to degeneration. But also the more amyloid deposition that we talked about leads to worse sleep because you don't sleep as deeply, you have more neuronal activity. So it's a vicious cycle there. And to clarify also that the sleep disorder breathing goes both ways. You can have sleep apnea because the centers of the brain don't let you breathe deeply, but you can also have sleep apnea because you're obese and the peripheral mechanisms don't let you breathe briefly. So the hypoxia that accumulates or happens eventually can cause to degeneration both ways. So closing, getting into the practical aspects, what are things that are important for us? So first of all, one thing I always remember is I had this patient and she comes to me and she was 67. She says, "I'm okay. My sleep is okay. I wake up 3 times though in the middle of the night and I go pee." I'm going, okay, so her prostate is enlarged. And it didn't fully make sense. So thinking about it and reading the literature, what turns out is that as you have sleep apnea and you have hypoxia, you send signals to your brain where you make your brain think it's okay to pee during the night. And that's not what the brain normally does under sleep. So you end up peeing during the night. So if you end up peeing a lot during the night, that's one thing to keep in the back of your mind. Do you have sleep apnea? And indeed, people that have been treated with a CPAP or with surgery do improve as far as their brain saturation, the ability, the oxygen saturation, and also decreasing the amount of nighttime awakenings to pee. How about dementia and using the CPAP in dementia patients? There's one good study on that, and it was in 52 Alzheimer's patients. And giving CPAP did improve the sleep qualities. People did enter that deeper sleep. And also in one of their cognitive in a combined outcome measure that they looked at, there was a positive effect to cognition. They actually performed better as far as their thinking went. In overall analysis, when you look at overall, how does cognition improve? How does our thinking improve if we treat sleep apnea? The only marker that is really improved is vigilance, so the ability to be alert during the day. A couple of things for the Alzheimer's patients is that of the different studies that have been done on different medications that have been given for insomnia, melatonin didn't work, ramelton didn't work, but trazodone has worked objectively. Probably melatonin could work, but the studies were not tweaked in a way for that population to work. But for trazodone, it's a very safe drug, and I don't get any money from them. But it's a very safe drug, and it increases sleep by about 40 minutes at the lowest dose that we give it, without any side effects the next day. No sleepiness the next day in our population. Another thing we touched on earlier was the acetylcholine. So a common drug that we give to our patients is donepezil or Exelon, rivastigmine, and so forth. And when your physician prescribes it or to your family members, they may prescribe it at night because that's how their electronic medical records pops it up. But actually, we know that if you give it at night, people don't sleep as well. They have more insomnia. Not only that, we know also that if you give acetylcholine at night, the non-REM sleep is not as prominent, so you don't consolidate that episodic memory. So you give it in the morning, you allow the body to have more acetylcholine during the day, which you do need for alertness. You do encode information during the day. And then you have less amount of that during the night, so you can go through your deep sleep and consolidate memories as well. And there are studies that show that there is a benefit in giving it in the day. So some last two slides. First, what to discuss with your physician. So tell them, what's the time to bed? What time do you get up out of bed? Do you go to the bathroom at night? How long do you sleep? Are you that great sleeper that sleeps 10 hours every night? And then if you're acting out your dreams, are you really living the dream? Should you be looking for ways to treat? Because there are treatments for these things. and discuss with your, with your physician exactly how you take your medication, not only what medication you take, but also what time you take it. You saw Benadryl has effects that can lead to sleepiness, but it also affects memory. For example, we really shy away from it in our population of dementia patients. And then ask for your physician if there's any questionnaires or sleep diaries that you can fill out. Now, some things for yourself, just in general, and I include myself in that, is that what should I pursue? Like, as we age, since we know that keeping a good sleep pattern helps us prevent, or likely helps us prevent brain degeneration, what should we do? So one thing is sleep hygiene, and there's a lot of stuff in that. Some important factors to consider are be exposed to light during the day and sleep, consolidate your sleep during the night without having light exposure or TV and stuff like that at night. Exercise during the day. Have a schedule during the day. Avoid caffeine or other stimulants after 2 in the afternoon. No alcohol in bed near bedtime because it causes a rebound insomnia in the middle of the night. So you have that red wine right before sleep or a nightcap, and 3 o'clock in the morning you're wide awake, and that screws it over. There's a trick in showering about an hour or two before the desired time of sleep. Remember, we talked about the temperature, the body temperature. So if you bring up your body temperature by having a warm shower, a hot shower, you come out and then your temperature starts dropping. So you start feeling a bit sleepier. It's not perfect, but it's one way we can intervene, especially for our dementia patients. And then think of medications and consider agents that can be avoided. So that's it. Thank you very much, and we'll carry on.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Alexis.
All right. So let's get started. These are the main sleep disorders, you know, that a clinical sleep center will look at, and I'm just going to really focus on insomnia. But the big ones are sleep apnea, which you've heard about, narcolepsy, periodic limb movement disorders. We haven't gone into that much, but it's leg kicks in the middle of the night that have kind of a rhythmic quality to it, almost like a metronome. Circadian rhythm disorders, you know, jet lag, night shift problems, irregular sleep-wake timing, and then my favorite, insomnia. But, you know, the approach to this is sort of, in some ways, it's the same. I mean, you think about what is the problem. Is it sleepiness? Is it insomnia? And this is sort of the basics of a good clinical assessment. How long has it happened? When did it start? When does it get worse? How's the person's general health? You know, do they have any comorbid medical problems, pain? Are they taking pain medications? Are they depressed? Have they ever taken antidepressants, alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, family history of sleep problems, and of course, lifestyle and stressors. And then of course, you do want to rule out kind of major sleep disorders, sleep apnea and periodic leg movement disorders. Sleep logs are actually quite helpful. You know, and a variation of that are some of these fitness wearables that some people do, and you get instant feedback on your sleep. And I actually think that to some extent that may be an intervention in its own right. People tend to shift their behavior a little bit to maximize that sleep score they're getting on their Fitbit or whatever it is. And I don't work for the Fitbit people. But in any event, diaries are very monitoring sleep, in fact, can change behavior of sleep. And of course, the thing that we're interested in is the timing of sleep, sleep onset, how continuously you remain asleep during the night, and whether or not you are a night owl or a morning person. So in any event, this is what a sleep log looks like, and usually something when you go to bed at night, you report on some things about the day. You know, did you take any naps? Did you use caffeine? And then in the morning, when you wake up, you fill out a report of how the night went, how long it took you to fall asleep, and how long you felt like you slept. When do you go to a sleep lab? When do you go to see Shelley? So clearly, if you're worried about sleep apnea, if you're worried about your bed partner having sleep apnea, and that's usually what happens. It's somebody who notices that their bed partner snores loudly and their breathing is interrupted by loud gas. Or if there's a leg kicks, again, it's usually the bed partner report gives you a pretty accurate diagnosis. Sometimes dangerous behaviors at night, people acting out their dreams. Or there's a certain percentage of people with epilepsy who only have seizures during the night. Or if they have severe sleepiness, that's a scary symptom because the risk is falling asleep while driving an automobile. Insomnia generally is not a symptom that you refer people to the sleep center for, except when they've when first line treatments have failed. And then in which case you really start to worry that there is an occult sleep disorder that you haven't picked up. But in the absence of that, sort of generic insomnia, it's not really an indication to go to a sleep lab. Okay, what are some of the insomnia comorbidities? Many, many things. Heart disease, pulmonary disease, pain problems. Pain is sort of a double-edged sword. Pain will keep you awake and pain medications. Alessia has talked about the states where you're tired but not sleepy. Opiate pain medications can make you feel less alert, but they do not make you sleepy. And in fact, there's actually been really nice studies show that opiates, actually all of them, tend to have an activating effect on the EEG. Some people are actually subjectively aware of it themselves. Percocets. So some people are aware of the fact that the opiates have a stimulating effect. Most people don't. Most people feel as if they're under the influence and they're less alert. But objectively, their sleep is activated. Endocrine problems, both hypo and hyperthyroidism. Nocturia is a big issue for fragmenting sleep, both in men and women, actually. I've already mentioned pain. And of course, in my field, psychiatry, depression, and stress disorder are major causes of chronic insomnia. And then I've already mentioned these major sleep disorders. So the first line treatment for insomnia is behavioral treatments. You can actually distill the essence of behavioral treatment to a single phrase, and that is spend less wake time in bed. So that means you only go to bed when you're sleepy. It means that if you have trouble falling asleep and you're lying in bed awake, you actually get out of bed. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't fall back asleep, you get out of bed. What you're trying to do is you're trying to eliminate the association with the experience of lying in bed with being awake. So spend less wake time in bed. And you do this by, sleep restriction is actually a big intervention there, where you sort of limit the opportunity that you give yourself to be in bed. And that actually is an interesting issue because a lot of people with chronic insomnia sort of develop a strategy of just spending more time in bed on the idea that if you have that much more time in bed, you're increasing the opportunity for sleep to occur. But unfortunately, what that does is that it sets up this linkage with lying in bed, being in the sleeping environment, and getting used to the fact of being awake for hours at a time. So sleep restriction means you just don't limit that time you're in bed. Cognitive therapy is sort of addressing people's worries and anticipation of what might happen to them if they don't sleep that well that night. The idea is that your brain won't work at all if you have a bad night of sleep. Sleep people tend to speak out of both sides of their mouth. When they write a grant or they write a paper, they say, sleep problems are killing us. There are all these medical problems that occur with them. And that's actually true. But the real thing is to say that chronic sleep problems are associated with those morbid outcomes. But intermittent insomnia is not going to kill you. And in fact, your ability for your brain to work pretty well the next day is actually quite good. And so the cognitive work of helping somebody with insomnia is to forget about tonight. You're worried that you want to change behavior that ultimately has an impact on long-term sleep-wake habits. But to forget about tonight, get person less focused on, am I falling asleep? Am I getting sleepy? Is it happening tonight? Is it going to happen? I need to sleep tonight because I have this talk tomorrow. The more you're focused on sleep, the more you feel to you try to willfully make it happen, the less likely you're going to fall asleep. You can't be there when you fall asleep. Right? So you have to give up the idea of willfully making it happen. So that's the cognitive work. You actually have to get people to actually feel less frightened and frantic about occasionally having bad sleep. Because when it happens, it's not that big of a deal. All right. Relaxation training, I actually think of that as something like playing a musical instrument. It helps if you have talent. And then it's practice, practice, practice. It's not something you can kind of flip on PRN. You know, you're flying to New York and you want to turn on your relaxation tape to fall asleep. But if it, on the other hand, if you have a practice that involves some daily approach, whether it's meditation or deep breathing or yoga, whatever, if it's part of a habitual practice pattern, then it is very useful for sleep. Okay, so here's the interesting thing. The over-the-counter sleep medications are actually pretty toxic. And you can kill yourself on 2 weeks' supply of Benadryl. That's sort of the shocking thing. So the Benadryl and the sleep over-the-counter drugs, they do make you sleepy. There's actually a lot of drugs that make you sleepy. And in some ways, you have to kind of turn the problem upside down. As physicians, we're not trying to make people sleep more. We're trying to make them feel more alert and attentive and functional during the day. And once you adapt that attitude, it really changes your thinking about what treatments are acceptable for sleep. You know, because there's a lot of sedating drugs out there, and a lot of them have inappropriately long half-lives, including the antihistamines, diphenhydramine. And, you know, they're especially not well-tolerated in older people. They can actually have significant cognitive problems. So, all right. These are most of the insomnia treatment medications. And there's kind of a funny story here. A lot of these are benzodiazepines. These are the older school sleeping medications. The decision of a drug company to go for to make their benzodiazepine a hypnotic drug as opposed to an anxiolytic or anxiety drug, that was entirely a marketing business decision. And it had nothing to do with the pharmacologic properties of the drug, actually. So some of these drugs actually aren't as lipophilic, don't go into brain as rapidly as some others. But the big issue here is this. These drugs are just so long-acting. If what you're really trying to achieve is to improve daytime alertness and daytime cognition, these old-school hypnotic drugs, flurazepam, which is Dalmane, and in fact there's a metabolite of Dalmane that has a half-life of about 200 hours. It's almost like a depot hypnotic drug. It's something that's just in your body for a long time. Now, the newer drugs, these so-called Z drugs, Zolpidem, Ambien, Zaleplon, Sonata, Esopiclone, Lunesta, you know, in fairness to them, they actually do have more appropriate half-lives. You know, that they're not as long-acting. That's a good thing. But the idea that they're sort of somehow a much cleaner drug than the older benzodiazepines is not necessarily that true. So can I ask for a show of hands, how many people here either themselves or know a person who have ever had a funny behavioral experience on Ambien? So, you know, maybe about 20% of the people here. It's not a trivial amount. Okay, so anyhow, there's a couple issues here, and I'm going to come back to the Ambien story, is that I worry a lot about half-life of these drugs because the same property that promotes sleep at night is the same property that diminishes alertness and vigilance during the day. That's not what we're trying to achieve in clinical medicine. All of these drugs, all of the benzodiazepines and the Z drugs are going after GABA. Now, we showed you pictures of these sleep-wake centers, and there was one center called the ventrolateral preoptic nucleus. This is where GABA is. Well, unfortunately, GABA is in a lot more places than this one nucleus. In fact, it's everywhere. It's in the cerebellum, it's in the brainstem, it's throughout the entire cortex. And the problem with giving a GABAergic drug is that you are under the influence when you have that drug on board. It affects motor coordination, it affects arousal, affects memory, cognition. So, what's this? This is a picture of a small platoon in eastern Afghanistan. And featured right here is a 19-year-old named Zachary Boyd. And this photograph went viral on the New York Times years ago, in part because he's wearing boxer shorts that say, "I love New York." But what this story is about is that Zachary had been asleep for 2 hours when they had incoming fire. And so there's fire coming in, and he immediately gets to work. He puts on his body armor, and he gets to work. So the Defense Department has recognized for decades that people deployed in a war zone are not sleeping well. And people who aren't sleeping well make errors. They make mistakes, and they make errors of omission, errors of commission. And they've actually decided that in the risk-benefit calculus, it's actually better to give sleeping pills to soldiers who are deployed in a war zone, because sleep loss from sleeping in a hostile environment leads to operational problems. So they use Ambien in a war zone. So I asked this question about how many of you either personally or know somebody have had an untoward experience on Ambien. That's because this is increasingly recognized as a problem. You give these drugs, they're under the influence for, you know, ideally 6 hours, sometimes eight, sometimes longer. But if you give somebody, if you take a medication every night, some night it's going to happen. The phone is going to ring at 2 o'clock in the morning, or the fire alarm is going to go off, and you're going to have to act while you're under the influence. So more and more attention is paid for the fact that the acute cognitive effects of these drugs really are important. So let's talk about, you recognize this this slide here. So I mentioned GABA. GABA is everywhere. You know, anywhere I point here, there's GABA that's inhibiting areas of the brain. But then there's this area, this orexin. So, you know, I mostly work at the VA hospital, so I tend to think like this. Orexin works almost like the federal government. So a lot of the circuitry of sleep-wake behavior is organized around wake. But wake comes in lots of different flavors. It comes in these different, there are different wake-on centers. And you can kind of think of these big wake-on centers are like the large states. You know, we've got New York down here, and we've got, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio, and we've got Texas, and then Shelley's favorite neurotransmitter, dopamine, which of course is California. So what orexin does is that it actually ensures that all of these wake-on centers and the different flavors of wake act in tandem and in coordination. And when you lose that coordination, that gives you the fragmented wake states during the day and the fragmented sleep states at night that you see in narcolepsy. But the interesting thing is that if you antagonize orexin with an antagonist, you do make people sleepy, but the interesting thing is that animals, given these orexin antagonists, when you awaken them, like Zachary Boyd, they're not ataxic. They seem to perform pretty well on mazes and different sort of, you know, tests of animal cognition. So we were interested in actually testing the same thing. This was funded by the Defense Department because they're actually keenly interested in this issue, and we were comparing two different doses of an orexin antagonist versus a standard benzodiazepine receptor agonist, zolpidem, versus placebo. And we're dosing people in the afternoon because we're really just testing the acute cognitive effects. And we're looking at measures of cognition before dosing and immediately after. And the idea is that we thought that zolpidem would be have a much more acute effect on cognition, but that the orexin antagonist would be less problematic because, again, the big states, histamine and cholinergic centers and norepinephrine, they're not antagonized with an orexin antagonist. So we dosed people at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. 100 milligrams was the standard hypnotic dose for almorexin. 200 milligrams was double that dose. And zolpidem is a standard dose of Ambien versus placebo. And I'm going to just cut to the chase. We had about 203 people, a lot of UCSF graduate students. Thank you very much. Healthy, normal people, ages around 26. And so here's the punchline here. So this is looking pre-dose, and this is looking post, and this is comparing Ambien. This is the lower dose, standard hypnotic dose. This is the higher dose versus placebo. And if you looked at the continuous performance task, where higher scores are worse, that you saw a big effect of zolpidem and not on the two doses of orexin antagonist. If you look at lapses in vigilance or reaction time, you can see that there's a bigger effect of zolpidem, less so on the 100 milligrams, a little bit of an effect of 200 milligrams of almorexin or placebo. Again, this is just higher peak on this curve is bad in terms of number of cognition. And another mean reaction time, same issue here, zolpidem is not so good. Standard hypnotic dose, not so bad at all. Double the hypnotic dose, you can see an effect, no effect of placebo. So, and then here's an interesting feature. All of those things I just showed you involved an active task where they had to do something. They had to react to something being presented to them. However, if you ask them to try to stay awake in a completely dark environment, lying motionless on a bed, semi-recumbent, in a darkened room, and you gave them these doses, it turned out that you see a hypnotic effect. And so in the absence of an external task demand, you see evidence of sleepiness on these drugs. So just to summarize, for most cognitive measures, performance under the standard sleeping pill, zolpidem, was quite a bit worse than an orexin antagonist or placebo. There were performance decrements for the orexin antagonist, so there's no such thing as a perfect sleeping pill, but they were quite a bit better than zolpidem, but greater than placebo. And then finally, cognitive measures demonstrated a dose effect. So this is the time for our Q&A.
So the question was, how does the use of smartphones and just having screens in the middle of the night change our sleep patterns and also behaviors? And I suspect you also imply other problems that come down the line as a result of these sleep problems. And since it is more recent, yes, we don't have a lot of prospective data, but we do know that if you do turn off your smartphone at night and you follow these sleep hygiene patterns where it includes also not watching TV in bed and not being exposed to the screen and not eating in bed and other stuff like that, you do consolidate your sleep better. And the theory is that you achieve that, you avoid all the other stuff that are related to poor sleep patterns.
Yeah. This was all over the New York Times. And I think the punchline of that study was that so the question was that people who like a hunter-gatherer group was studied and sleep, and the results, the punchline was that there was fragmentation of sleep, an average duration of sleep around 6.5 hours, less than what was sort of reported, where we say as a society we are sleep deprived, that our counterparts 120 years ago slept an hour and a half more than we do now. It was somewhat of a contradictory finding, saying that it may be that 6.5 hours is such a scandalous amount of sleep.
I actually want to make a comment because this is actually a general misconception. There isn't an amount of sleep you need. You need the amount of sleep you need to feel refreshed. We sort of talk about averages sort of around somewhere between 7 and 8, but and we talk about sort of pathologic ranges. But for any individual, you need the amount of sleep you need. So don't get worried. Like when there were these big campaigns, oh, you need to have 8 hours of sleep a night. And I literally had patients in my office, doc, I sleep 7 hours. What's wrong with me? And the answer is there's nothing wrong with you as long as you're feeling alert during the day. So we really need to focus much more on the quality of our sleep than on the quantity of our sleep.
So the question is, how do we manage sundowning? And the answer is, first, it's very difficult. The second is that there are ways you can address it. And you have to think of what causes it. So one thing is, are there medications that do add to sundowning? Because you have somebody who is not fully alert and they enter this sleep state. Are they, let's say, on Benadryl or other medications that... Well, that's what my thinking is, that if somebody's sundowning, so sundown means that as it's closer to nighttime, traditionally, people start having abnormal behaviors. And it's not just that they're tired, it's that they are really disoriented, they could be combative, they could be confused, they can't process information properly. So this one theory says that because you have shifted when you secrete melatonin, you end up being awake but not asleep, being awake with high melatonin levels, and the different networks of the brain, the sleep and the wakeful networks, overlap. So you have elements where you won't be, while you're asleep, you're not fully aware, you're not attentive. So that affects your performance during that period of time that you're awake. So what do? You try to shift, on one hand, if you need to, you try to shift the melatonin secretion. It's not always possible. And you can do that by light exposure. And the timing of the light exposure plays a role, what time of day you do it. The studies that we discussed on if you give melatonin, does it actually help? The answer is, early on, it probably... there is a study that says that it doesn't. And the theory behind it is that melatonin administration makes sense if you're trying to bring somebody earlier into sleep, or if they are lacking amounts of melatonin. But really early on, people have a good amount of melatonin. It's just that the timing of melatonin is shifted. So you can do tricks, especially the lighting is a huge way of achieving that. Exercising during the day, timing the stimulants, the coffee, let's say, or whatever you're taking appropriately. And then making sure that there are no other medications that can add to sundowning as an effect. You see people in hospitals, and they have screens on, they have lights on, they have Benadryl rather than another hypnotic, and so forth. So, as a physician, it's a more what I would say simply is talk to the physician in charge, address and somebody who knows how to think of these things and have these things addressed as a whole, not just one thing.
That's my question. Restless leg syndrome is my absolute favorite sleep disorder to treat. So I'm going to wax poetic, so you're going to have to try to stop me on that. Restless leg syndrome is the subjective discomfort of the urge to move the legs that has a circadian rhythmicity, so it's going to be worse in the evening than it is in the morning. It is, and that can be all it is, just some discomfort, sitting, trying to watch television. It can also be associated with insomnia and with fragmented sleep during the night. When we do sleep studies on people with restless leg syndrome, we see these periodic limb movements of sleep, which are these very periodic leg jerks. Dr. Nolan described it beautifully, like a metronome. It's like, every 20 seconds generally on average, but there is a range. So, as most people with restless leg syndrome, I never want to say everybody, but it's essentially everybody, will have periodic limb movements of sleep. However, there are people who have only the periodic limb movements of sleep without the daytime discomfort, without that urge to move, that creepy crawly feeling, the feeling like their ants crawling or electricity in the legs. Some of those people just have periodic movements of sleep. It's an incidental finding. We did a sleep study. Oh, isn't that cute? Some of them have actually fragmented sleep in association with those leg movements. At that point, it's called a disorder, and that's periodic limb movement disorder. So Dr. Nyland brought it up because it can be an occult, it can be a very subtle thing to diagnose in cases of insomnia, because these aren't people coming in saying, ooh, I have this weird feeling in my legs. I just have to get up and pace. I can't sleep. These are people who just, they have nothing in the evenings. They're fine. But they have difficulty sleeping. They wake up unrefreshed, and they're kicking a lot during the night. So that's what periodic limb movement disorder is. So it is actually separate, but it's an allied condition with people with restless leg syndrome. I have some just sort of as one more aside from that, there are certain medications that can cause periodic limb movements of sleep, but very frequently, if I'm seeing them as an incidental finding on a sleep study and somebody who's not on a medication that can cause it, they often will have a family history of restless leg syndrome. And so they're totally asymptomatic. I'm treating their sleep apnea, but I see this incidental finding, and I almost wonder if it's a form frust or if it's going to develop into restless leg syndrome. So they're allied but not identical.
So the question is, what's the long-term effect of taking Ambien? The answer actually isn't well known. I mean, there's been a handful of studies that have looked out at 12 months. And in general, people, so the surprising thing is that there's usually, you know, sustained efficacy, even though people the idea of tolerance has been a big part of the clinical lore, both for benzodiazepines and Ambien. But there's no known long-term sort of, you know, progressive decline that's shown with chronic Ambien use. As I was saying before, if you kind of think of it as just in like a probabilistic term, that if you take something where for 6 hours you're under the influence, at some point in over a year or several years, you're going to have to do something in the middle of the night, you know, and try to drive somebody to the emergency room. And that's the scary part. Yeah. All right, I'll run with that. So, you know, there's a whole world of what's called lucid dreaming, where you're in a dream state, probably rapid eye movement sleep, and you have the subjective awareness of the fact that you're sleeping and you're dreaming. And people like that idea because they like to feel like they could have some executive control over their dreams or whatnot. But the fact is, if you're in that state and you're aware of it, you're also going to be aware of the fact that you can't move because your skeletal muscles are paralyzed. It could be that people have experienced this in sort of brief fragments of various issues, but the dream of I'm being chased and I feel paralyzed and I can't move is almost ubiquitous. It's such a common, you know, scary dream.
And you think it is connected to REM
growth? That's my guess, yeah. The thing about dreams is that you can't directly measure them. All you can do is wake people up and get them to write down what they're experiencing, but we can't really directly measure dreams. Yeah, you know, that's a great question. So, you know, insomnia there isn't a single definition of it. Typically it's seen as, you know, trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep. But it's actually not a problem unless you can actually yoke it to some actual daytime impairment. You just don't feel rested. You don't feel like you're alert enough. A certain amount of fragmentation of sleep at night is actually kind of normal. You know, it's normal to have awakenings across the night. It's only a clinical problem when people feel as if they're not getting a sufficient amount of sleep and they don't feel attentive during the day.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.